is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for tuning in on this first Sunday of the summer. We have a lot to cover, including the latest on a big story that WMRA first reported on back in December, and that is allegations of severe abuse at the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center near Stanton. Jesse Nadler did our original reporting on that late last year, but last week, a report by the Associated Press got more national attention. We'll have an update on that story coming up, and we'll hear Jesse's reporting again. Also, two reports from Jordy Yeager on how two of Virginia's most famous historical residences, Monticello and Montpelier, are finally telling the broader truth about two of our slave-owning presidents. But first, an update on this week's big story. Yesterday, a crowd gathered in a rally at the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center near Stanton protesting reports of severe abuse there. On Thursday, the Associated Press reported on half a dozen sworn statements from migrant teens held at the center. Children as young as 14 say they were beaten while handcuffed and left nude and shivering in concrete cells. There are other allegations, and they are all part of a lawsuit by a detainee at the center. And that lawsuit will get a hearing in court in July. Later on Thursday, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam ordered state officials to investigate the claims. He said the allegations are disturbing, and he ordered the state's Secretary of Public Safety and Homeland Security to report back to him about conditions inside the facility. And on Friday, Senators Tim Kaine and Mark Warner sent a letter demanding more information from the Department of Health and Human Services. The center is one of only three juvenile detention facilities in the U.S. with federal contracts to provide housing for potentially troubled migrant children. The alleged abuse predates the Trump administration. For much more background on what's going on with this lawsuit, let's go back to the original reporting by Jesse Nadler back in December. The suit was filed by a 17-year-old Mexican boy detained at the center. It details the inhumane conditions roughly 30 unaccompanied immigrant children confined there are allegedly facing. Their crime? Entering the United States often alone to flee violence south of the border. Here is the first of Jesse's two-part report.
His name in the lawsuit is John Doe. It alleges that from a young age, he was traumatized by gang violence in Mexico. At 15, he fled the country but was picked up by ICE at the border. It says he was eventually transferred to the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center just outside of Stanton. It is one of two maximum security facilities that house unaccompanied alien children in the United States. The lawsuit accuses the center of failure to provide adequate mental health services for prisoners such as Doe, who are survivors of trauma. It alleges violence, psychological abuse, and excessive seclusion and restraint by an ill-equipped staff. Doe says he cuts himself and bangs his head against the floor to deal with feelings of desperation and helplessness. The center did not respond to requests for comment. The lawsuit echoes what other immigrant detainees have told Holly Webb, a third-year law student who works in the Immigrant Rights Clinic at Washington and Lee University.
They are running from terrible situations that most people can't imagine, like the kinds of violence and things that they've been through and seen. It would be comparable to a soldier coming back from a war.
Most of the kids come from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Webb and a fellow student helped one young Honduran apply for asylum. This child grew up in the violent city of San Pedro Sula and had been abandoned by his parents.
There was a neighborhood there that was actually called the Colony of the Dismembered.
The gang MS-13 descended on his neighborhood. People barricaded themselves inside their homes.
But the gang wanted this house that my client lived in, and they just took it over. I mean, they came up and showed up with guns and were like, we're taking your house. They tortured people on the porch. The kids, they saw it through cracks in the wall.
After years of tyranny, the child and his sister fled. Along with John Doe and 30 others, he's now housed at Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center. It's one of a network of facilities contracted by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the agency charged with the care and placement of undocumented children. The number of kids in federal care went from 6,600 in 2011 to more than 57,000 in 2014, according to a report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office. The surge caused ORR to scramble for beds, contracting with more detention facilities. David Baluarte is a law professor at WNL and a director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic.
And there is no state protection for these kids. So they come here in search of protection, and that oftentimes ends up being an asylum claim. Now, the asylum claims are very difficult to win. Legally, they're very challenging.
If unaccompanied kids can't be repatriated, either they say they're fleeing violence or they have no home to go back to, they may be released to family or another sponsor in the United States. Barring that, they stay in shelters, foster care, or detention centers. Those deemed dangerous go to Shenandoah. But some kids end up in these restrictive facilities unnecessarily. Some have been coached to embellish stories of their upbringing in order to bolster an asylum claim.
Some of the claims are pretty wild about very young children claiming to have used weapons against multiple narcotraficantes who are conducting child sex slavery.
Seth Michelson is a poetry professor at Washington and Lee who works with these children.
So even if it were true, the child escaping sexual enslavement would be a traumatized survivor of sexual abuse and a refugee.
The irony is that these stories, embellished or not, can be used against them later. Webb again.
When they come into the facilities, they have clinicians and doctors, but nothing that they say is confidential. So whatever they report to their doctor also reports it to ICE. They're kids, and they tell them that they can trust them and tell me all about your situation. And then they go and file a report, and that's how they get kicked up in security levels.
Baluarte again.
You need to look in the face of these children and understand what they've been through. What this lawsuit has brought to light is not just that we're detaining these kids in such desperate need of help, but that we're detaining them in deplorable conditions. The circumstances in which they're being detained really aggravates some of the deep psychological trauma that they've suffered and that they need better care and treatment.
Webb's client never made it out of confinement. He was transferred to an adult prison upon his 18th birthday.
In part two of her report, Jesse explores how these undocumented youth cope with confinement and trauma.
Once a week, Washington and Lee poetry professor Seth Michelson travels to the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center just outside of Stanton.
How can I help you?
Seth Michelson here for poetry.
All right, go on in.
Thank you.
He teaches poetry to unaccompanied alien children detained there.
Buen día, chicos. ¿Cómo estamos?
Bien, bien, bien. Buen día.
The minors range in age from 13 to 17 and hail mostly from Central America. They're locked up for crossing the United States border illegally, seeking to escape violence back home. Shenandoah Valley Detention is one of two maximum security juvenile facilities in the country. The kids are locked up there because of the danger they purportedly pose to themselves or others. Their migration stories are often horrifying. Violence, abandonment, sexual enslavement. Michelson uses poetry to help the kids work through past trauma. Reporters aren't allowed into the facility, so these recordings were made by Michelson.
I forget. Without reason to exist, I often forget that I am real, and this makes the soul I don't have ache, as if I'm walking somewhere, unable to find myself.
Some of the kids were conscripted into gangs and drug cartels before fleeing for the United States. A mural at the center features paintings by the children.
One child's work with the cartel was to dissolve dismembered body parts in vats of acid. That's what he painted as representational of his past. I mean, this is a child who's been through severe trauma.
But the immigrant children at this facility are not receiving adequate care and attention. This, according to a class action lawsuit filed in October by a teenage detainee from Mexico. It alleges beatings and psychological abuse by guards. Children are locked in their rooms for 12 to 14 hours a day. Nutrition is substandard. Meals are often served cold. Some of the kids don't even know why they're there.
Marriage. Yesterday in my cell, my pal asked, "Man, don't you want to marry life forever?" And I answered, "Why marry life if I can't divorce death?"
The brutal conditions of their confinement may end up re-traumatizing the children, according to the lawsuit. Michelson uses the weekly workshops to try to inject a little beauty and hope into their lives.
Poetry gives them a language to think about what they've been through, why they came here, what they hope to achieve and become. How they've suffered, how do you cope with a lonely night?
The workshops serve as a form of therapy.
Somebody reads something beautiful and everybody bursts into applause, and it's really special in that way.
The alternative coping method that is so prevalent among this population is disturbing and deadly. Aaron Ferber is a former student of Michelson's who has attended some of the workshops.
1 week, I asked one of the kids, like, oh, where are your glasses at? And he's like, oh, they were taken away from me because I was hurting myself with them. It's heartbreaking. I don't think there's another word to describe that.
Self-harm and suicide attempts are widespread. The lawsuit alleges indifference by guards. Michelson says he worked with one child who attempted suicide 6 times. I asked if he ever worries about giving these children false hope.
If it's false hope to keep them from committing suicide, then I'm glad that it's a functional false hope at least. Every one of these kids, in different conditions, would thrive. They'd do great in the local high schools. They'd be on the local soccer teams and the local dance teams. They would be dating and working.
A collection of their poetry has been published in a new book called Dreaming America. Most of the kids have never before owned a book.
So their first book that they possess is a book that they helped to write.
He hopes it gives them a will to live despite a very uncertain future. Proceeds from sales go to a legal defense fund on their behalf.
Thank you very much.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
After that story originally aired on WMRA in December, the center found out that Seth Michelson was talking about his experiences there, and they told him he was not welcome to come back anymore. The Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center is operated by a consortium of 7 local governments in the valley, and we will continue to cover developments in this story on the air and in the WMRA Daily podcast. A week ago Saturday, just outside Charlottesville, several hundred African-American descendants of people enslaved by Thomas Jefferson gathered at Monticello for the unveiling of a new exhibit. Their ancestors are finally having a say, and WMRA's Jordy Yeager reports.
We are 6th-generation descendants from Jefferson and Sally Hemings through their son, Madison Hemings.
25-year-old Zach Fisher and his brother David came from Pittsburgh for the opening of Monticello's long-awaited new exhibit called Look Closer. It's centered around 4 rooms on the level below Thomas Jefferson's mansion. The rooms are where he forced some of the more than 600 people he enslaved to cook for him, and it's where some slept. For years, David Fisher explains those rooms were something else entirely.
It just shows how far we've come. I remember coming here, and they were bathrooms before. They were just this low. They didn't know what they were, and now it's something important. It's something special. It creates an intimate experience where you can actually catch a glimpse of what life may have been like back then, whereas before there was not much of any representation.
Nearly 500,000 people tour Monticello every year. The vast majority are white or from other countries. Following James Madison's Montpelier, the new exhibits are part of Monticello's effort to try to tell the story of the enslaved, which for most of our history has been ignored or covered up. Monticello's conducted more than 200 oral histories that shape parts of the new exhibits. And that ancestor of Zach and David's, Madison Hemings, back in the 19th century, he wrote a detailed family history that the new exhibits incorporate into the narrative. But as renowned historian Annette Gordon Reed explained, for many years, his writing was largely discounted because he was black.
The notions of white supremacy, the ideas of white supremacy, filtered down into the historical process, the way historians looked at this document as something untrustworthy, something that was not believable. Listening to people, having empathy for people, letting black people share power, because it's telling a story and being believed is a powerful thing. To have influence is a powerful thing. And when we let enslaved people tell the story of slavery, participate in the telling of the story of slavery, you change the historiography, you change historical writing, and I think it's a step towards changing the American story.
Next to Annette Gordon Reed on a large stage at Saturday's gathering was Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation, one of the world's largest philanthropies with a $12 billion endowment. Walker said Jefferson could have freed the people he enslaved, but he valued his wealth more. Walker drew a parallel to today's wealthy.
They hem and haw and say, oh, we know it's bad. We know it's terrible. We know it's morally reprehensible. And the things that are said in Charlottesville was so offensive to me. But I'm going to buy a new big house in the Hamptons because my taxes are going down. And so I think the lesson for American history has not been learned. that the outcome of greed over democracy and justice ultimately will render us a poorer nation.
The country was founded on slavery, and its effects continue, from lynchings and Jim Crow laws to redlining, police brutality, and racial disparities at every juncture. The new Monticello exhibits don't address these in much depth, but Walker, seated next to billionaire David Rubenstein, one of Monticello's largest donors, didn't shy away, saying that power in this country needs to be reallocated.
When I talk to philanthropists, I'm interested not in a conversation about what are you giving back, what are you giving up? Because that's a big difference. I'm really not interested in a conversation that says, let me tell you, I want to be more generous. I want to move from generosity to justice, from the idea of charity to dignity.
J.C. Jefferson Jr. and his father, Calvin Jefferson, traced their ancestry back to three families enslaved by the former president, the Hemings, Grangers, and Jupiter Evans, Thomas Jefferson's personal servant. J.C. and Calvin said, absolutely, equity is the goal. But that's a long process.
It's going to take a long time to chip away at that because no one wants to relinquish power. Power is not going to be relinquished by someone waking up and saying, oh, okay. I mean, we're seeing a resurgence of this because we came close. I mean, we had President Obama doing what he could to try to level the playing field. And then, you know, what did America do? America said, well, we're going to go back another few steps. So hopefully, you know, with stories that are coming out of this plantation, we can kind of see that, I mean, we're all human. And I think that's what Jefferson, I think he knew that. Of course, that the times didn't dictate that's, you know, he could actually talk about that. Because if he did, then he wouldn't have been wealthy, and most of the white men would not have been wealthy. It took free labor to build this wealth and build this privilege.
The new exhibits are a good first step, descendants said. In the future, among other things, they want more time and money spent on the enslaved burial grounds. And some called attention to the fact that this new exhibit will make Monticello money. But they found solace, they said, in President Leslie Green Bowman's recent announcement that Monticello is forming a partial college scholarship fund for high school seniors whose ancestors Jefferson enslaved.
And almost exactly 1 year ago, after years of careful planning, James Madison's Montpelier opened its extensive new permanent exhibit on enslaved families and slavery, which in many ways broke the mold before the most recent updates at Monticello. Jordy was there at Montpelier last June for this report.
Jerome Bias is a living historian. He travels the country, demonstrating what life was like 150, 200 years ago. You can probably picture him, billowy white shirt, grayish-blue trousers, uncomfortable-looking shoes. But Bias depicts not just any 19th-century life, but the life of an enslaved African-American. Over the years, he's been to dozens of historic sites. And when it comes to their portrayal of race and slavery, he's noticed something.
Most sites are afraid to go and have those hard conversations. Most sites take the perception of what will be comfortable for our white visitors.
Today, Bias is setting up a cooking demonstration at President James Madison's Montpelier in Orange County. And there are mostly white visitors. But last week, Montpelier opened a new, extensive, multi-million-dollar exhibit that takes visitors beyond Madison's story alone and delves into the lives of the 300 African Americans that he enslaved and whose labor his family profited from. The exhibit is called A Mere Distinction of Color, and it's a tapestry of intersecting displays, artifacts, and testimonials spread throughout the plantation. There's the physical changes to the property itself. Less than 50 yards from Madison's mansion stand two giant reconstructed slave quarters and two smaller smokehouses. It's where they originally were, right near where Bias is cooking today. But Montpelier didn't want just another exhibit on slavery, like you see at any number of historic sites. And so they began a crucial process of asking living descendants of the enslaved, what do you want? And it's those voices that visitors hear at the displays inside each of the slave quarters. Buildings the descendants themselves helped reconstruct. Descendants even partook in the archaeological digs, as did Bias around this time last year.
It's so wild to see African Americans wanting to participate in the historical field. Where before we've never been invited to, never participated in, and you see this woman who's a descendant being an archaeologist, digging in the dirt, and she keeps plowing away at it. We're going, it's lunchtime, and she keeps going, and she finds a silver cufflink with a nice little glass stone on the top of it. And she's got the biggest, most wonderful smile on her face. I mean, what else can you say to that?
A stone's throw away in Madison's mansion are two new exhibits that run the length of the cellar. One relates the personal stories of the enslaved at Montpelier with listening stations, an interactive map, old documents, and a film that depicts the horrors of seeing your family broken apart by slave traders. The other exhibit delves into the national system of slavery. It pinpoints how every state prospered from enslaving black and brown people and how America would likely have failed as a country if not for their forced labor. It details how slaveholding states got more representative votes in Congress and were able to shape the first laws of the new country. But then, the exhibit goes a step further. Christian Coates is the director of education and visitor engagement.
One of the other things that we wanted to do, and again, this is coming through talking with these groups of descendants that we work with, was bring it to the present, right? Everybody ends slavery in 1865. And that's fine if you're white, right? But if you're an African American, slavery is still a part of your world, right? And it's not that long ago.
Seated in the basement of the house once owned by America's fourth president, the framer of the Constitution, the lights go out and a 10-minute film begins.
People coming to Montpelier can't help but be struck by the contradiction between the words of the Constitution and of the reality of slavery. Slavery was profitable, and the richest people in America depended on it for its profits. You need to remember that 80% of all American exports by 1860 are produced by enslaved people.
And then the film goes to a place that no other historic site has really taken it.
Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He has no weapon. He has no weapon.
The video connects the past to the present.
And when you're living constantly with the fear of going to jail because you fit the description or because you can't afford a lawyer.
Chaney McKnight is a living historian and was up from Colonial Williamsburg to help Bias with the cooking demonstration for the day. She and Bias say the new exhibits raise the bar for every other antebellum historic site. And that's important for many reasons, she says, but namely, it bucks the trend of portraying the enslaved as inferior in their capacity.
If you think that about the enslaved persons, what do you think about their descendants? What do you think about their humanity? If you can't find the empathy for this experience that they had, that they lived through for generations. If you can't have empathy for that, then how do you feel about the situation of the African American community now?
Montpelier's new exhibit is a significant step towards having a deeper conversation on race, the conversation that's been on the tip of our tongue for 150 years. Now, there's hope. We may finally be finding our voices. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.